Okay, so this first session here is called a math primer session. So what's that all about? Well, basically, the language of nature at the most fundamental level is mathematics. Okay, so when we're talking theoretical physics, which is the study of nature at the most fundamental level, the language of theoretical physics is mathematics. So while you can read like lots of popular books about physics, you know, a Brian Greene book or a Stephen Hawking book and so on, which has virtually no mathematics in it, if you really want to understand how nature works more deeply than that, you really have to start delving into mathematics. So when researchers are talking to each other about their ideas, sure, there's a lot of yak, 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 but there's a lot of scribbling equations on the blackboard. Okay, so just ideas and ordinary language coupled together with mathematics are really how ideas are developed and evolved. So mathematics is extremely important to being able to do theoretical physics. Okay, so one of the things, one of the sort of difficulties that we face with the ISSYP is that all of you guys are very smart. But all of you guys have different levels of math background. So some of you are like, you know, super calculus people. Some of you haven't seen calculus. So there's a wide range of backgrounds, you know, opportunities that people have had, and so on and so forth. So you come to us with different math backgrounds, and so what we'd like to do is develop the course material in such a way that it uses as little mathematics as possible. Okay, so while I said math is very important, and indeed it is, you can get a lot across with a minimum amount of mathematics. So a lot of time has been spent developing courses in special relativity, general relativity, and quantum theory that use as little mathematics as possible. But we do need some mathematics. So the idea for this session is just to give you is to bring everyone up to speed, make sure everyone is on the same page as far as the mathematics go. Okay, so most of you will actually be sort of on this page, and it'll be fine. But we just want to make sure everyone is sort of at the same place and has the mathematical tools, skills that are necessary to get the most out of these modern physics lectures. Okay? And then with your mentor, you might do a mentoring project which involves more advanced mathematics. And so if, for example, some mentoring projects, it's really helpful to have calculus. So if you know calculus, then you can go in and work with those mentors. If you don't have calculus, there are lots of projects that will not involve calculus. Okay, so anyway, but that's a whole separate issue. The mathematics that we're going to be talking about here is just what's going to be helpful to get the most out of these quantum and relativity courses. Okay, blah, blah, blah. Is that all clear? Super. Okay, so why don't we start with a couple of topics. We're going to talk about basically binomial series is one topic, and we have some exercises here and with their solutions. And so we're going to do basically different sections of mathematics, and at the end of each section of math, we're going to do some sort of exercises right away. Okay, to get you guys going on the idea, so it's not just me yak, 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 it's you trying to like struggle with these things and do some exercises, okay? So it's going to be really, really fun and helpful to do these things. So we're going to do binomial series, infinite series, a bit of trig, and a bit of imaginary and complex numbers. Okay, so let's start with binomial series. How many of you are familiar with binomial series, just off the top? Okay, so about half of you. Okay, so we're just going to give a I'm just going to give a very short kind of presentation of this. I'm not going to be mathematically rigorous or anything. We don't really care about that. What we care about is sort of what are the end results, understanding how to use them. Okay, so when it comes to theoretical physics, theoretical physicists tend to use mathematics as a tool, as opposed to a pure mathematician who pushes the boundaries of mathematics. Okay, you know, actually develops new mathematics. Theoretical physicists tend to use existing mathematics. However, that's not entirely true, especially with the advent of things like string theory and loop quantum gravity. And as we push deeper and deeper into how nature is actually working, theoretical physicists are pushing the boundaries of what mathematics is capable of. Okay, so there are kinds of mathematics which nature just seems to be pointing to, which no one knows anything about. Okay, and so theoretical physicists help to push the boundaries of mathematics. Okay, Anyway, so let's start with binomial series. Okay, so the kind of question that we're interested in here is something like, we have two things, a plus b to some power n, where n is an integer. Say 0, 1, 2, a non-negative integer like that. Okay, so we want to find some expression for this. We want to expand this out. Okay, one thing to notice, and this is important, just a general simplification of this, is if a is positive, you can just factor a out. So you can write what's inside the brackets here as a times 1 plus b over a, all to the power of n. Okay, so you can just factor out that a to the n. That's just a to the n times 1 plus b over a to the n. Okay, so really we don't care about this guy in front. We know how to do that. Okay, it's this thing that we care about. So we really care about expressions that look like 1 plus something to the power n. Okay, so that's what we're going to focus on, first off. Okay, so okay, so let's start with the simplest case. Okay, so what is that? Get a yell out. One. Okay, one. Okay, so anything to the power of 0 is 1, and I'm going to put the 1 over there as well. Okay. 1 plus x to the 1 is 1 plus x. Excellent. Okay, and so the coefficient in front of here is just 1, and that's just 1. You'll know what I mean in a second. Okay, so we'll put a 1 there and a 1 there. Okay, so what's that? Okay, so we're starting to develop a pattern here. Okay, so the coefficient here is 1, the coefficient there is 2, the coefficient in front of the x is just 1, 1 times x squared. So it's 1, 2, 1. Okay, so let's look at cubed. 1 plus x cubed. Anyone know that off the top of their head? Okay, so if you just take 1 plus x times 1 plus x squared, this guy, and just multiply it out longhand, you're going to get that expression there. Okay, so if we read off the coefficients here, it's 1, 3, 3, 1. Okay, and so we're building up this sort of table of values here, this little triangle of values. Does anyone recognize a pattern developing in this triangle? Yeah. Pascal's triangle, excellent. Can someone tell me what the pattern is? Yeah. Okay, super. Okay, so we notice that that the 2 here is 1 plus 1. And so that's basically that row. This row here, the 3 there comes from 1 plus 2. The 3 there is 1 plus 2. And so if we were to write down this next row, what would I put here? What's here? Okay, so if we believe that we've identified the correct pattern here, then we would immediately be able to write down 1 plus x to the power of 4 is 1 plus 4x plus 6x squared plus 4x cubed plus x to the 4th. Okay, and then we're done. Okay, so that's really great. In fact, this is true, and you can prove this. What's helpful here is this Pascal's triangle, it's called, is very, very useful for working with expressions where n is small. Okay, but if n is like 100, you got to build up a pretty big table, right? So what we want is a more general mathematical formula for these coefficients. Okay, and so there are lots of ways to derive that kind of general expression, and I'm not going to actually do that because it's not worth the effort. We're just sort of more interested in the final result. So I'll just tell you the final result, which is going to be extremely useful to us. Okay, so at the end of the day, you can show that 1 plus x to the n has a general expression. The first term is 1. All of these are just 1. Okay, the second term, what's the second term in terms of n? Just nx. So when n is 0, it's just 0. When n is 1, it's just 1 times x. When n is 2, it's just 2 times x. When n is 3, it's 3 times x, and so on. So the next term is just nx. That one we can guess very easily just by looking at a couple of cases here. The next term, can someone guess what the next term is? So that'll be the x squared term. So it's a 1 here, it's a 3 there. So it goes 1, and then it goes 3, and then it goes 6. The next one is 10. Does anyone know what that next term is here? Yeah, so n combination 2. So I'm going to write that in a slightly simpler form. In fact, I'm going to write this as, so you can see the pattern developing. I'll write n as n divided by 1. So the next one is n divided by 1 times n minus 1 divided by 2. Okay, so that's times x squared. And then there's an expression in there's a coefficient which sits in front of the x cubed, which over here is 1, and it's 4, and so on and so forth. And can anyone guess just from this pattern, n over 1 times n minus 1 over 2, can anyone guess what this next one is? Plus dot dot dot. Okay, so there are a couple of important cases here. So first of all, when n is an integer, so when n is say 0 or 1, a non-negative integer, so on and so forth, what we notice is that this series of terms here terminates. It ends. It stops at some point, and then there's no more afterwards. Okay, so for example, when n is equal to 0, we plug in n equals 0. Well, that'll make that term 0 because that n is 0. It'll make that term 0 because there's an n. It'll make that term 0 because there's an n. But there's an n in all of these terms. Okay, and so all the terms are 0 except for the first one, which is 1, which was this guy over here. Okay, when n is equal to 1, we get 1 plus 1 over 1x is 1 plus x. But there's an n minus 1 here, so it'll kill that one. 1 minus 1 is 0. There's an n minus 1 there. That term will be killed, and all subsequent terms will be killed. So all you're left with is a 1 plus x, which is what we have here. And similarly, for n equals 2, we have an n minus 2 here. 2 minus 2 is 0. So this term disappears, and all higher order terms disappear. And you're just left with these first three terms, which is 1 plus 2x plus x squared. Okay, so when n is a non-negative integer, this series terminates. Okay, and it's valid for all values of x. Okay, so now here's something really, really important, a super important general lesson in how mathematics and theoretical physics work together. If we look at this expression was derived for the case that n was just a non-negative integer. We derived it by just working out these powers, looking at this Pascal's triangle, and I didn't show you how exactly, but you can simply derive this expression here. Okay, but as soon as you have some mathematical expression, the first question you ask is, well, what if I push the limits, push the boundaries? Right now, this series was developed for n being a non-negative integer, 0, 1, 2, 3. What if we put n equals 7.2 or negative 5.3? Okay, or even an imaginary number. What if we put in some different value for n here? Okay, and it turns out that this series is in fact valid for values of n that are not just positive or non-negative integers. So, for example, if we stick in n equals minus 1, let's just see what happens. Let's just see if this actually works. Okay, so what we're saying is, 1 plus x to the minus 1 equals, this is a question mark here, we're going to stick it in, n equals minus 1. So what are we going to get? 1 minus x, so let's write it as this, plus negative 1 over 1 times x. So we get that. If we work that out, what we get is 1. This is negative x. This is negative 1, negative 1 is negative 2. Make that negative positive 2 over 2 is just 1. So it's just plus x squared. The cubed one is negative 1, negative 2 is negative 3. Negative 3 over 3 is negative 1. Negative 1, negative 1, negative 2 over 2 is negative 1. Negative 1 over 1 is just negative 1. So it's negative 1 cubed is negative. Okay, so that's negative x cubed. And you can guess the terms after that. So it's 1 minus x plus x squared minus x cubed plus x to the fourth minus plus and so on and so forth forever. Okay? So one thing you'll notice is that if we go outside of this range here of non-negative integers, we notice that the series does not terminate. The series is actually an infinite series. So let's just write an infinite series. Okay, so that's the big difference. But actually, do we know that this is really right? Okay, well, let's see. How could we define an independent way of verifying that 1 plus x to the minus 1 is this expression? I think we could do that. Yeah. We could substitute in values. So for example, we could put in the value, say, x equals negative 1/2, stick it in here, and see if that works. Okay? And in fact, suppose we took x equal to minus 1/2. 1 minus 1/2 is 1/2, to the power of negative 1 is what? 2. Okay, so it should be 2. So let's see if this works. We would have 1 minus negative 1/2 is plus 1/2. Negative 1/2 squared is plus 1/4. Negative 1/2 cubed is negative 1/8. With that negative is a plus 1/8. And so on. So let's see if that works. So that's 0, that's 1, and that's 2. So the first term takes us from 0 all the way up to 1. Okay, and then the next thing takes plus 1/2, so that means take half of what's left here, plus 1/2, plus 1/4. 1/4 is 1/2 of what's left, plus 1/8. 1/8 is 1/2 of what's left, and then 1/16 is 1/2 of what's left, and so on and so forth. And if you add up all the terms in that infinite series, you will indeed get 2. Okay, so that actually works. I'll leave it as an exercise for you to try x equals 2. We tried x equals 1/2. Let's try x equals 2. Okay, see if it actually works. Okay, anyways, another way to do this is simply by longhand division. Okay, so 1 plus x to the minus 1, well, what is that? That's just 1 over 1 plus x. Okay, we would just do longhand division. Does anyone remember how to do longhand division? Excellent. Okay, so we would go 1 plus x, depends on where you learned how to do this, but the notation I would use is like this. So 1 plus x goes into 1 how many times? Well, start with 1. So 1 times 1 plus x is 1 plus x. When I take this, subtract this, the remainder is negative x. So what do I put here? Negative x. So negative x times this is negative x is the first one, and then I get negative x squared. The remainder is positive x squared. Okay, so this next one is positive x squared, and so on. Okay, so just by longhand division, we verify that, in fact, 1 over, or 1 plus x to the minus 1 is, in fact, 1 minus x plus x squared minus x cubed, and so on and so forth. This series, and I hope we have time to do this, but this series is very important, a series very closely related to this. And this whole idea of does this series work for all values of x and so on is very, very important in a really amazing physical effect called the Casimir effect. And hopefully, how many of you have heard of the Casimir effect? Okay, a couple of you. Really amazing, freaky fact about our universe that we might talk about in quantum if we get time. Okay. Anyway, so this kind of mathematics plays a role there. Right. Okay, so let's try another example. Let's try n equals 1/2. Sorry, let me leave this blackboard up here. Okay, so we'll try n equals a half. So what do we get? 1 plus x to the half. Let's see, where's our general expression? So it's up here. Let me just pull it down a little ways. Okay, so when we put n equals a half, uh-oh, stay down! Okay, so n equals a half, we get 1 plus a half x. The next term is a half minus 1 is negative a half, over 2 is negative a quarter, times a half is negative 1/8. So it's negative 1/8 x squared. What's the third one? I mean, you can do that in your head quickly. 1/16, plus 1/16. Okay, so the signs alternate, plus, minus, and the powers go down, 1/2, 1/8, 1/16, that sort of thing. Okay, so let's check if this is actually right. One way to check is to supposedly this is equal to all this junk over here. So if we multiply this by itself, 1 plus x to the half times 1 plus x to the half, what do I get? 1 plus x. So supposedly, all of this junk on the right-hand side here, if I multiply it with itself, I should get the same thing. So let's see. So 1 plus a half x minus 1/8 x squared plus dot, 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 dot. Now just multiply this expression by itself. So you're multiplying two infinite series together. Sounds like a big job, but you can actually do it just sort of term by term. So if you go 1 times all of this junk is 1 plus a half x minus 1/8 x squared and a whole bunch of other terms. Now take 1/2 x times all of this junk. So the next one is plus 1/2 x. And 1/2 is a quarter x squared, so plus a quarter x squared, and higher order terms there. And then we take negative 1 over 8 x squared times all of this junk. Okay, so negative 1 over 8 x squared times 1 is negative 1 over 8 x squared, okay, plus x cubed terms and higher and higher. Okay, so what you'll see is that what we're left with is 1. So this whole thing equals 1, plus a half x plus a half x, that guy and that guy is plus 1x. And you'll notice that we've got negative 1/8 x squared plus a quarter x squared, negative 1/8 x squared is just 0. Okay, for the x squared term. And similarly for the x cubed terms, you'll see that they're all 0. So all those other terms are 0, so in fact it does work out. Okay, so what we've done is we've just sort of verified in kind of an ad hoc way, case-by-case basis, just a couple of examples which show that that expression, which I'll put a box around because it's a very important expression, we show that that expression is in fact valid not only for non-negative integers, 0, 1, 2, 3, and so forth, but also for negative integers, negative numbers of any kind, just all real numbers. It also works for complex numbers and so on and so forth. Okay, so it's a very, very general series. Very, very powerful and useful series. Okay, well, let me talk a little bit about what happens when x is small, because this is actually the main point of why we're doing this series. It turns out we're going to get an extremely useful approximation, which is going to be of great value to all kinds of physics that we're going to be doing. Okay, so let's take a simple example. X is 1/10, which is small compared to 1. Okay, so so let's work this out. So using this, the square root, say square root of 1, square root of 1.1. What is the square root of 1.1? Well, we can write that as 1 plus 0.1 to the power of a half. Okay, so we have an expression for 1 plus x to the half up there. Okay, so let's just plug it in. So we're going to get 1 plus a half times x, 1/10, negative 1/8 of x squared, 0.1 squared is 0.01. A whole bunch more terms. Okay, so if you crank that out, what you get is this is let me write down the terms individually. Okay, so this one here is 1. This is a half of 0.1 is 0.05. This is 0.1 squared, 0.01 divided by 8, what's that? 0.00125. And 1/16 of 0.001 is 4 zeros and then 625. Okay, and so what you notice is that when the value of x is small, the first term here is the biggest term. This is the biggest term. And then the other terms get smaller and smaller, successively smaller and smaller and smaller. And what we're going to argue at the end of the day is that if x is small enough, it's a very good approximation just to terminate the series here and say it's approximately 1.05. Okay, so let's actually look at that in a little bit more detail here. So, okay, so let's actually look at it at a slightly different expression here. There's the rates. And if I'm going too fast, just stop me. Say, hey, Richard, stop. Question? Okay, all right. So so let's look at 1 plus x squared. So we know that that's 1 plus 2x plus x squared. And let's take x equal to 0.1. Okay, so if we do that, we get 1.1, that's 1 plus 0.1 squared, is equal to 1 plus 2 times 0.1 plus 0.1 squared. Okay, so that's 1 plus 0.2 plus 0.01. Okay, so it's 1.21. But what we're interested in is how rapidly these next terms are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So if we take the ratio of this next term to this previous term, so I'm claiming that this is the most important term, let's look at how important it is compared to this next term. How good of an approximation is it just to ignore that term? Well, let's look at the relative sizes between this guy and this guy. Okay, so the ratio of these two, 0.01 to 0.2, okay, is a small number, is 0.05. Okay, so it's only 5%. So you, by dropping this next term, you'd be making an error of only 5%. Okay, but now let's see what happens when x gets smaller. Okay, what we're going to see is the error in dropping those higher terms gets even smaller. Okay, so if we take x equal to 0.01, okay, so 1/100th that value, it's 1.01 squared. Okay, so if we work that out, that's 1 plus 2 times 0.01. plus 0.01 squared. Okay, so let's work that out. That's 1 plus 0.02 plus 0.01 squared is 0.0001. Okay, so we can add up those three terms, and what do we get? Zero, two, zero, one. Okay, so now we're going to ask, okay, so the answer is approximately 1.02, and what's the error that we make in dropping that last term there? Okay, well, let's take the ratio of this term to this term. How big is this term compared to that term? And so taking the ratio of those two guys, 0.0001 0.01 over 0.02. Okay, so if you work that out, that's 0.005. Okay, that's only 0.5%. Okay, so here it was 5%, now we're down to 0.5% there. So anyway, so you get the point here. The point is that the smaller we make x, when we're going 1 plus x to any power, whether it's 0.5 or 2 or 5 or 100 or whatever, no matter what power we have here, as we make x smaller and smaller and smaller, the approximation of just dropping all those higher order terms and just keeping that first term gets better and better and better. Okay, so in fact, what we can say is that, so the notation that we use is something like this. We say 1 plus x squared is approximately equal to just 1 plus 2x. So if you look at the first term there, it's just 1 plus 2x. We have also the plus x squared, but we're going to ignore that as being small compared to this. So this expression is valid for x very small, which we write as the magnitude of x, the absolute value of x, we put bars around it, we mean absolute value of that number x, is not less than 1, but much less than 1. So we make a double less than sign, much less than 1. Okay, so that's introducing some notation there. Okay, and that's a very, very important approximation. In general, we will see in your life as that involves mathematics or theoretical physics, you will often see things like this. Some function of x is approximated as some kind of a series, 1 plus ax plus bx squared plus cx cubed, and so on. Okay, so this function of x, which might look like, you know, something whatever like this or whatever, some function of x. So there's x axis, and when x has this value, the function is this value. When x has this value, the function is that value. Okay, so this is just some function here, and you will find that functions can be approximated as series like this, in powers of x with certain coefficients. Okay, and when x is small, then x squared is much smaller than x, and x cubed is even much smaller. And so we can just drop those terms for small x and say this is approximately 1 plus ax, and just keep that first coefficient for the magnitude of x being much less than 1. Okay? So in our case, what we're really interested in is the binomial series. Okay, so we're interested in 1 plus x, not just to the power of 2, but 1 plus x to any power n, or n is a non-negative integer, or any real number, or in fact, any complex number. Okay, so what is this? When x is small, what is that? 1 plus x is approximately what? 1 plus nx. Approximately 1 plus nx. When x is very small. Okay? Super. So there's lots of examples that we could do, and you can verify that for yourself. Here's a really important example of that, which is really cool. You know, I think you're going to like this. So what do I do with the eraser?
That's what you're.
I'm going to leave that for you to figure out. So what we tried is x equal to minus 0.5, and it worked. And what did you find? It's a problem.
Right. So this expression is actually valid. Okay. So this expression here, when n is a non-negative integer, is valid for all x. Valid for all x. When we go away from this, then sometimes we encounter cases where it's not valid for all x. So in this case, it turns out to be on the x-axis, it's valid for x in this range between minus 1 and 1.
Okay.
And the first example we took was a half. So that's within that range, and the series works. Okay, but if you go outside of that range, then the series doesn't work. So the series encounters a singularity, actually, over here. And you get that street map over here as well. But the function is valid. It's outside of that. So
that's right.
So a series that represent function. Yes, so you can find series that
will work outside of that as well, but they would look more complicated than this. But absolutely you can't. Yeah, I mean, ultimately, what does this function look like? So the function is 1 over 1 plus x. So let's see. So let's sketch this function. So here's x. So when x is really, really large, when x goes to plus infinity, so we're way over here, what is the value of that function? Right, so 1 over a very large number is basically 0. So it's basically 0 and infinity. When x is, say, 0, its value is 1. So it's 1 over here. When x is minus 1, what is it? 1 over 0 is infinity, so it blows up. Okay, so it has a singularity here, as a pool. Okay, so let's do this. So for large x, it gets small like this, and then it goes up like this. We know its value here, and we know that it just blows up there. So it blows up like that. What if x is slightly less than negative 1? Negative infinity. So it comes from negative infinity, and what does it do for large negative values? Goes to 0 again. Okay, so that's what that function looks like. And we've got a series expansion for that function, this guy over here, which is valid in this range between minus 1 and plus 1. Okay, if we wanted to find a series valid, say, near here, x equals 2, what we would do is we would use some calculus. And we would find a different expression that also involves a series that would work around this value of 2. In fact, for any function, no matter what it looks like, you can always find near some value, you can always find an approximate expression for that function that's valid within some range. Sometimes the range is infinite, from minus infinity to plus infinity. Sometimes it's finite. When the function has a singularity, that's going to be a point at which the validity of the series breaks down. But yeah, so short answer is, yeah, you can find other series that are valid for x equals 2 for that function. Okay, okay, so this is a really cool example. So what is Einstein's most famous equation? Wrong. close though. You get like 90%. E squared equals very good. Okay, so in this expression, E is the total energy of a particle. So we're talking about some particle, like an electron or this object or whatever, or a planet or something like that. In physics, a particle can be very small, can be very large, depending on your perspective. Okay, so E is the total energy of that particle. M here is the rest mass, or just the mass. And P here is the momentum of the particle. What is the momentum of the particle in terms of its velocity? Mv. Actually, it's only approximately Mv. This expression for momentum is valid. The idea that momentum, P, equals Mv, is an expression that's valid when the velocity is small compared to the speed of light. Okay, when the velocity becomes comparable to the speed of light, then the expression for momentum is more complicated. Okay, this is actually only an approximation. Okay, and of course, c is the speed of light. Right. So what this says is that when the momentum of the particle is zero, okay, so when I have an object at rest with respect to me and I'm looking at this thing, like this eraser here, this thing here it's at rest with respect to me, its momentum is zero, and so all that's left is the square of the energy is m squared c to the fourth. So taking the square root of that, I got E equals mc squared. E equals mc squared applies to objects at rest. And it's saying that this object, even when it's at rest, it has some energy. Okay, if there were a way to convert that matter into pure energy, there's a tremendous amount of energy in that eraser. Okay, something which people prior to Einstein didn't realize. Okay, anyway, so let's just look at this expression here. So that's when p is zero. When we increase the momentum a little bit, so when this guy is now moving, okay, the square of its energy is this guy, like it was before, but now we add something to it. We add some p squared term to it. So its energy increases as it begins to move, okay, which makes sense. But in a way that's a little bit more complicated than what we know from Newtonian worldview. Okay, so let's take the square root of this guy. E squared is equal to what? Square root of m squared c to the fourth plus p squared c squared. Is that right? Are you sure? Plus minus, right. So the plus minus is actually very important. We're not going to be dealing with plus minus here, but it turns out that this plus minus is a very, very important fact. I mean, just generally in mathematics, whenever you come up with some expression or you're working through some mathematics and you're trying to solve a problem, sometimes there's more than one solution. So in this case, the solution to what is E has two solutions. It's plus or minus this square root thing. Both of those will solve this equation. And in physics, this is the power of mathematics and physics is just amazing. It turns out that once you get an idea in your head in the form of mathematics, then you can use that mathematics, find different solutions, push the mathematics as far as you can, find all possible solutions. And it has invariably turned out in almost all cases that when you look at weird things like that, like weird solutions that you might at first think don't mean anything, they always turn out to mean something very, very deep. Okay, and in this case, this minus sign is associated with antimatter. Okay, so it's way cool. But anyway, we're going to ignore the minus sign for now. Okay, just plus sign. Okay, so so what do we do? How can we take this expression and make it useful, or put it in a form that's going to be whereby we can use our expression up there? It's this guy over here. Let's just put it back up here again. Or this guy here, actually, this is what we want here. Okay, so how can we get this expression into this form? 1 plus x to some power. Factor out this guy. Okay, so let's factor out that. So this is square root of m squared c to the fourth times 1 plus p squared c squared over m squared c to the fourth. Okay, and so this, the square root of m squared c to the fourth, well, that's easy. That's mc squared. And then we have 1 plus x to the power of a half, where x here is p squared over m squared c to the fourth. That's the power of a half. Okay? So this expression as it stands right now is exact. This is the total energy of a particle in terms of its mass and its momentum. But now what we're going to do is we're going to say, well, it's got this ugly square root here. We would like to simplify this expression. What if this expression is small compared to 1? What if the momentum, p times c, is small compared to mc squared, its rest energy? Okay. So in fact, under what conditions is that, in fact, the case? Well, let's have a look. Okay, so when an object's speed is small compared to the speed of light, the momentum of the particle or the object is just m times v. So if we take x equal p squared c over m squared c to the fourth, and plug in for P and V, we get what? Okay, so the mass cancels out. One of these C squareds cancels out, and we get the square of V over C. Okay? So this expression here, for everyday, for object, that expression is very, very small compared to 1. For example, for the space shuttle, I'll let you work it out. For the space shuttle, this is V over C is approximately, I just worked it out, 0.00027. Okay, so the space shuttle is going at, what is it, 29,000 kilometers per hour. Sounds really fast, but compared to the speed of light, as a fraction of the speed of light, it's a very small fraction. Okay? And so it's almost negligible compared to the speed of light. So this is a small number. Okay, so this guy over here, we can write then as energy is then approximately equal to mc squared times 1 plus that expression p squared c squared over m squared c to the 4. We'll just work that out to be v over c squared to the power of 1/2. Okay? And now this thing here, when this is small, when v over c is small compared to 1, or v over c squared is small compared to 1, we can use this very, very important approximation with n equals 1/2 here. So 1 plus anything to the 1/2 is approximately 1 plus 1/2. So this is then approximately mc squared times 1 plus 1/2 of this thing. Okay, and so if we expand that out, the first term is mc squared. What's the next term? Plus what? Mv squared over 2. So the c squareds cancel out, and you're left with plus 1/2 mv squared. So it's saying that so we started with Einstein's exact expression up there, which is valid for all velocities, all particles, all situations. And we took the special case where the velocities are small compared to the speed of light, like space shuttle, like people walking around. We found that Einstein's expression reduces to this expression. It says that the total energy of a particle, of an object, is mc squared, just its rest energy, just sitting there, it has energy inherent in it. Mass and energy are, in essence, the same thing. Okay? So mc squared plus this thing. For virtually all objects, for all ordinary objects, mc squared is huge compared to this thing. This is what? What's it called? The kinetic energy. This is the Newtonian kinetic energy. So it's saying that the total energy of the particle is this huge amount of rest energy plus this 1/2 mv squared kinetic energy of its motion. And typically, so this is just essentially a constant, which for a long time was unknown until Einstein. Okay, so there's actually another problem on this in your exercises, so I'll just leave that. And that. Okay, so it is 10 o'clock, and we have until 12 o'clock. Yeah. Yes. So it gains, okay. So what does it mean to gain inertial mass, first of all? So the statement is that when a particle, as a particle moves faster and faster and faster, it gains inertial mass. Okay, so I just want to give you a physical sense of what that means. If suppose we're out in the middle of empty space and I throw this thing, it's just going to keep on sailing along like this, right? And now if it's moving relative to me and I try to push it sideways, okay? Well, suppose it's not moving. I try to push it sideways. I try to accelerate it sideways. Okay, well, that's going to involve some force because there's some inertia, resistance to changes in motion, acceleration. To get it to accelerate, to get its path to bend like that, I'm going to have to push. The more mass this thing has, the harder I'm going to have to make it a push on it to make its trajectory bend. Okay, now, if this object is moving like this, then its inertial mass increases. And so when if I were to tap it sideways like this, I would have to tap it harder than I expect to get its trajectory to bend because it has more inertial mass. And same if I'm behind the thing like this and it's moving, and I try to push it to make it move yet faster, it seems to have more inertial mass. It seems to resist acceleration. Okay, so so the actual expression for the mass. So the mass m star is m divided by square root of 1 minus c squared. So in theoretical physics, whenever you write m, what you mean by definition is the rest mass. How much mass does that thing have when it's at rest in front of you? Okay, what is the resistance to acceleration when it's starting at rest? Okay, so that's that guy. But when the object is in motion, it gains some effectively an effective inertial mass, which is related to its energy. And so this guy, if you divide by the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared, as v goes close to c, the denominator goes close to 0, and the mass gets really, really large. And so that has to do with the fact that you can't accelerate a massive object from rest to faster than the speed of light. You're going to hit this, like this is a singularity here, like one of these singularities. As v goes to c, it just goes up to infinity like that. And you hit a barrier, and you can't actually go from lower than the speed of light to faster than the speed of light. Potential energy is not in this expression. That's right. So this expression is for free particles. Okay, so what that means is you're in empty space with nothing else around it. Sorry? If we have some object near the particle, then the energy becomes a lot more complicated. The expression for energy becomes much more complicated. Let me clarify. So I said this is totally general, and it is in the absence of any other forces or interactions. So if you have a particle in the middle of empty space, just floating with some velocity, some momentum, that will be its energy. But when you start putting gravitational, other bodies nearby, and you ask about gravitational potential energy and things like that, the expression becomes a lot more complicated. In fact, the concept of energy is, first of all, I should say it's hugely important in physics. Energy and momentum are of foundational importance to all of theoretical physics. turns out, though, that when general relativity entered the scene around 1915, and people started to think about energy in the context of this new theory of gravity. So in Newtonian gravity, you talk about, oh, yes, this is the Newtonian potential energy, MGH, you know, that kind of thing, right? It turns out that it's a little more complicated, and in general relativity, it's very difficult to put your finger on energy. What is energy? What is gravitational energy? What is gravitational potential energy? That sort of thing. So what is known is that if you have, suppose you have some galaxies here. Okay, so here's a galaxy. That's not a very good galaxy. That looks like a crab. Okay, whatever. That's a galaxy, and that's a big star and other stuff, and there's an alien. Okay, that looks like a rabbit. Okay, so I'm going to stop drawing now. Okay, so anyway, so you've got some mass over here. This is called an isolated system, okay? So there's a bunch of junk here, which includes mass, radiation, electromagnetic waves, all kinds of stuff in this region over here. Okay, but then it's isolated in that as you go away from this region, there's no mass, and so space and time get all warped over here like crazy, and there's all these, you know, embedding diagrams and warping things and all kinds of cool things happening, but out here the space gets flat. Okay, so it's an isolated system. So in general relativity, it is known how to calculate and determine in a very sensible way the total energy of the system. Okay, so if I draw a big, huge sphere like this around the system, okay, and let the radius of that sphere go out to infinity, I can tell you, general relativity can tell you what the total energy is inside that system. The total energy of an isolated system in a universe that becomes flat at infinity. Okay, well, but obviously I don't want to know that. I want to know, like, what's the energy of this rabbit? I'm calling it a rabbit now. Okay, I want to know what's the energy of just that galaxy. I want to know what's the energy of that star inside that galaxy. I want to know what's the energy of me as I'm moving around and so on. Okay, well, it turns out that that is an extremely difficult question in the context of general relativity. Okay, and it's still an active area of research. So yes, we can determine the energy for the whole universe, but how do you determine energy for parts thereof? That's very, very tricky, and a very, very beautiful topic. And what it shows us is that general relativity, while it was developed in 1915, a very, very beautiful theory and so on and so forth, and we've been with it for a long time, and we've been investigating and trying to understand it, general relativity still has very important lessons to teach us, even at the classical level. Okay, so everyone here is, rah, rah, quantum gravity, and absolutely, rah, rah, quantum gravity, but also classical gravity is still not totally understood. Okay, there are subtleties like this, which are still being worked on today, which may, in fact, inform our ability to actually quantize the theory. What is general relativity actually telling us about the deepest, the true nature of space and time, and how things interact? Okay, is it not all that has been completely worked out? Okay? Right. So sorry, that was a long-winded answer. So we were going to do some exercises, right? Yeah. Okay. So here's the plan. So I'm going to just hand this guy out. So we're going to go through. We're not going to go through all of them. So the idea is, let me just start this going, and then I'll. Okay, and if you need more, I got some more over here. Is that working out up here? You need some more over here? Okay, so normally, especially in, we're not going to go in the bistro, right? Just for this one? Why don't we? Or we want to have a break at 10:30, right? Okay, so you guys are like strapped to your seats until 10:30, and then we're going to have a break. Okay, we're gonna have a break in the bistro. So here's the plan. So we've prepared a whole bunch of exercises. Michael has prepared a whole bunch of exercises, I should say, and so we've put a lot of work into this, and these are fantastic exercises, and the idea is they come in easy, medium, and hard. So while we're having these lectures, yak, you're listening, your things are making sense or they're not making sense or whatever, we're going to pause periodically and do some of these exercises just to sort of make sure that everyone is sort of getting it, because it's in doing the exercises that you realize that, yes, I do understand, or no, I still have some questions. Okay, so please feel free, as you're doing these exercises, to ask questions. And when we get onto the more complicated exercises, we're actually going to be going to another room, splitting into groups, and doing these things in groups and all that kind of stuff. Okay, so just for now, this is fairly simple. Why don't we just sit here and crank through this a little bit?
Power n, and we found that we could write this this function as this infinite series or finite or infinite series in x,
and in general this is a very, very powerful tool in physics. We can write functions of all kinds in this kind of a form, a plus bx plus cx squared and so on, that kind of thing. And important functions, for example, sine x or cosine x and exponential e to the x. So these functions here have very well known expressions of this form, okay? And they are very, 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 very useful expressions. And so that's what I'd like to turn our attention to for the next hour or so, is series expansions of these three very commonly used functions, the most important functions in basic physics. Okay, so let's start. Okay, so we're going to look at sine and cosine first, and then we're going to look at exponential, and then we're going to discover an important relationship between those three functions. Okay, when we talk about complex numbers. Okay, so how many of you are familiar with the sines and cosines and unit circle and all that kind of stuff? Okay, so almost all of you, so I'll go quickly then, or reasonably quickly. Okay, so what we do is we have a unit circle here, which means just a circle of radius 1. And what we consider is a point on that circle at some angle theta. Some angle theta from this horizontal axis, usually called the x-axis. This is x-axis, y-axis. I won't label them. Okay, so we're interested in a point on the unit circle as the angle theta changes. When theta is 0, it's here. When theta is pi by 2, it's here, and so on. Okay, so the function sine theta and cos theta are just projections of this line on this axis here, or that axis here, no matter if you're sine or cosine. Okay, so for example, sine. Okay, so let me just remind you of that we use radians for angles. How many of you do not know what a radian is? Okay, so the circle is divided up into 2 pi radians. So when theta ranges from 0 all the way around to 2 pi, 2 pi is about 6.28, the number 6.28. So when theta ranges between 0 and 6.28, you've gone fully around the circle. Okay, so you can divide the circle up in many ways. One of them is you can divide it up into 360 degrees or 400, whatever those units are called, or whatever. You can divide the circle up any way you like, or hours and minutes or whatever. At the end of the day, mathematicians divide the circle up into units called radians. So 360 degrees, if you're familiar with degrees, is the same as 2 pi radians. So all angles are measured in radians. And so theta, in going from 0 to 2 pi, this point will go from there and go all the way around. And what is sine theta? Fundamentally, sine theta is the projection of this this radial line on this vertical axis there. Okay, so when the point here is 0, when theta is 0, so our point is here, what is the projection of this line along this axis? 0. Okay, so let's just divide this up. So that's halfway is pi. We have pi. 1/2 pi. Okay, so when we are 1/4 of the way around the circle, so pi by 2 radians, so here, what is the projection of our radial line along this one? 1. It's up here. And when we're at pi radians, which is halfway around, the projection is? When we're at 3 pi by 2, 1/2 pi, 2/2 pi, 3/2 pi, what's the projection? -1. So that's down here. And we're at 2 pi, 0 again. Okay, and so we just fill in connect the dots here with the smooth curve. And that's the sine function. Okay, so this distance here is sine theta. And similarly, we can make a projection not on this axis, but along this axis and get cosine of theta. The cosine of theta we'll just put down here. And okay, and theta goes between 0 and 2 pi. With pi here, pi by 2, 3 pi by 2, and projection can be as large as +1 and as small as -1. Okay, so when the angle theta is 0, what's the projection along this axis? +1. So we're sitting there. When it's pi by 2, quarter way around, 0. When it's pi, -1. When it's 3/4 of the way around, 3 pi by 2, 0. And 2 pi, 1 again. So we just connect the dots smoothly. Like that. and that's the function cosine of theta between 0 and 2 pi. And obviously it's periodic. This thing can go round and around and around, so this function keeps on going down and down and down, or back. Okay, so that's that. I should also mention just this, just quickly. So why is radians such a useful measure as opposed to degrees? Well, if we have a circle of radius r here, and we consider a segment of the circle, so part of the circle here, an arc length here, from there to there, what is the length of that arc? Arc length s is what? In terms of the variables r and theta, theta r. Okay, so that makes sense because for a given radius, as we increase theta, we're going to increase this arc length. And in fact, what if theta is equal to 2 pi? What if we go all the way around and look at the arc length from there all the way around the circle to there? When theta is 2 pi, this expression becomes what? Okay, it just becomes s is 2 pi r, which is the formula for the circumference of a circle of radius r. Okay, so that's why radians are useful. Okay. Right. Okay, so that's that. Just a reminder of that. Now, let's find an expression, or let's use an expression, a series expression for cosine of theta, and try to make sense of why that series expression makes sense. Okay, so the basic question is this. Cosine of theta. If I say that theta is, you know, pi by 4, or theta is 0.076 radians or something like that, how would you determine cosine of 0.76 radians? How would you do that? Calculator, right. How does the calculator do that? Taylor series, right. So the calculator internally does it either by a lookup table or a Taylor series, and ultimately it comes from a Taylor series. The lookup table is generated by the Taylor series. So the Taylor series is this. So cosine of theta, where theta is just a variable here, like x, has a series expansion form which looks like this: 1 - 1/2 theta squared plus 1/24 theta cubed, or sorry, 4, minus 1/720 theta 6, and so on, dot, dot, dot. So there's an infinite number of terms. And you can see the pattern here. This is 2, 24 is 4 times 3 times 2 times 1. 720 is what? 2 factorial, just 2 times 1. This 24 is written as 4 factorial. Factorial meaning, the word factorial is the same as the exclamation mark there. So this means 4 times 2 times 2 times 1, which is 24. And this number here, 720, is 6 factorial. So it's just 1 minus 1/2 factorial theta squared, 1/4 factorial theta squared, 1/6 factorial theta to the 6, and so on. Okay, so that turns out that's a simple fact which you can derive using calculus or a variety of other means for what cosine of theta is in terms of a series expansion. Okay, and so if I had to figure out what is cosine of 0.76 radians, well, I would just stick for theta the number 0.76 here. I'd go 1 - 1/2 0.76 squared plus 1/24 0.76 to the 4th, and so on. I'd put that in my calculator and I'd grind it out and I'd get some number, and that would tell me what cosine of 0.76 radians is. So 0.76 radians, this is about 0.5. So 0.76 is around here. It would give me some negative number between 0 and minus 1, okay, when I plug it into that series. Okay. Is that right? 5 by 2? 1.5. Sorry, 0.7 is over here. Sorry. Okay, we're over here. positive number. Anyway, some positive number between 0 and plus 1. All right. So what I want to do is look at this expression and get a little bit of a feeling for how this actually works, because it's really cool. And it's an important skill to know how to do. It involves just graphing functions. Okay, so let's graph this function. Okay, so the first thing we want, so this is 0 here, okay, and we want to graph this function. Well, cosine of theta is, when theta is small, theta squared is really small, like suppose theta is 0.1, then theta squared is 0.01, that's 100 compared to 1. This is already 1/10,000. Okay, so when theta is small, these guys are small, and the function cosine of theta is approximately just equal to 1. If we ignore all the other terms there, cos theta is approximately just equal to 1. Okay, so the function 1 is very simple. Okay, so it's just this. Okay, so if theta is small, like around this range here, if the function is just approximately 1, well, I mean, we know that it does this, so the approximation breaks down if we make theta too large, but near theta equals 0, the function is basically just hanging around the value 1. Okay? But that's not good enough, because if we go too far away, well, we know that that function is a poor approximation, cosine of theta. So we need a correction for that. Okay, and so the first correction is this guy, -1/2 theta squared. Okay, so theta squared, if I just were to plot the function theta squared as a function of theta, what does it look like? Parabola. So it bends up like this, right? So it's 0 here, and then it goes up like that. So it bends up like that. So now I take theta squared, I multiply it by 1/2. Okay, so that means for every value of theta, the function, I just reduce its value to 1/2. Okay, so it looks now like that. That's 1/2 theta squared. I put a negative sign in front of it, and so I just invert it, flip it around. Okay, so that's -1/2 theta squared. And I want to add that guy. I want to add this function to this function. Okay, so when I add it at 0, well, this function is just 0. It doesn't change anything. When I go away from 0, then it starts to add negative numbers. And the numbers that it adds, the negative numbers that it adds, get bigger and bigger and bigger in magnitude for larger theta. So when I add the -1/2 theta squared to that function 1, add this function to this function, what I'm going to do is make no change here, but I'm going to start reducing the value here. And it's just going to be a quadratic like that. Okay, so to the next approximation, so this is just 1. This is the next approximation, which is 1 minus 1/2 theta squared. Okay. So that's already starting to look a little bit like a cosine. The cosine goes down like this, but then it has to come back up. Okay, so the actual cosine is, let's actually put the cosine in here. The actual cosine would look something like this. Go down. Okay, so what we see is that retaining just the first two terms in this series expansion for the function, just saying cosine of theta is approximately 1 minus 1/2 theta squared, what we get is this curve, which is which actually matches pretty closely to cosine of theta for small values of theta. But then it starts to disagree as we get further away. Like, obviously, this curve just keeps on going down to minus infinity. Okay, but the actual cosine picks up and turns upwards again. Okay, so somehow we need a correction to that, and that's this next term, a positive term, positive 1 over 24 theta to the 4th. Okay, so theta to the 4th is, if this is theta squared, like this, theta to the 4th, that's 1 over there, theta to the 4th looks more like this. Okay, so it's much shallower here for small values of theta, and then becomes very much more steeper for larger values of theta. So it doesn't have much effect here. Theta to the 4th has very little effect here. It starts to have effect out here and out here. Okay, so what we do is we have almost no effect here, and then we start adding a positive term, theta to the fourth. We start adding a term to this. So it will look something like this. And we'll just, it'll actually overshoot. It'll be slightly larger than cosine. And then out of here, it'll just go off to infinity. So this is 1 minus a half theta squared plus 1 over 24 theta to the 4. Okay, so it's a better approximation near theta equals 0, and it lets the approximation go further and further and further, and it even starts bending up, but after a while it bends up too far. Okay, so then we need a negative correction over here. That negative correction is going to make this curve a little bit closer to the actual cosine. And then instead of going off the plus infinity, it will go off the minus infinity. Because for large values of theta to the 6, like 100 to the 6, or let's say 10 to the 6 is a million, 10 to the 4 is only 10,000. So this term becomes much, much bigger than this term, and it's negative. And so it dominates. Okay, so it's a good approximation, makes it a better approximation to cosine theta. But instead of going off to infinity there, it eventually goes down to minus infinity. Okay, so that's 1 minus a half theta squared. Okay, and so on. So you get the idea. The point is that this is an amazing series. It turns out that no matter how big you make theta, no matter how big of a value of theta you stick into this expression, if you take enough terms in this expression, you will have corrections, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, which eventually take you right onto the function, as close as you want to get to the function. Okay, so, I mean, it obviously works well here, but the amazing and remarkable thing is it works well, it works even way out here. You just got to take a lot of terms. Okay, so let's do an example here. So let's look at let's pick in a particular value for cosine and see how well this works out. So cosine of pi by 2. So pi is 3.14 divided by 2 is about 1.57. So it's cosine of 1.57. Okay, so we're going to stick the number 1.57 into this expression. So 1 minus a half 1.57 squared and so on and so forth. Okay, and so let's look at that. Well, first of all, what is the exact value? Cosine of pi by 2 is what? 0. Okay, so it better be 0. Okay, well, let's see. So let's just look at the first two terms. 1 minus a half of pi by 2 squared. Okay, so you can just stick that in your calculator and you get negative 0.23, two decimal places. Okay, so we started with the value 1, which is just way wrong. 1 is very different from 0. Way wrong. Okay, and then we had a small a bit of a correction here. We brought it down from 1 down to negative 0.33, which is closer to 0. Okay, but not very close. Okay, so let's try having two correction terms. The next one is 1 over 24 theta to the 4th. Okay, so if you crank that out in your calculator, you get that. Okay, so about 0.02. Okay, so that's really close to 0 now. We've gone from 1 to negative 0.2. So you can see, let me just sort of sketch it here. We started at 1, and then the first correction brought it to negative 0.23, which is about here. The third correction took it to positive 0.02, which is about there. Okay, and then if we, the fourth correction, if we do all of this up to pi over 2 to the fourth, or sorry, to the sixth, I just cranked it on my calculator, and you get negative 0.00089, okay, which I can't draw on this. I can't distinguish that from 0 on the blackboard. Okay, so you can see that it actually is. So in fact, I should have probably drawn it over here at pi by 2. But this is the actual cosine function like this. the first approximation took us to here, the next one took us to there, the next one took us to there. Okay. So you can see that it actually works. Yay, it actually works. I'm not making it up. Okay. So the point here is for small, one point is that for small theta, cosine theta is approximately 1 minus 1/2 theta squared. Okay, which is like our binomial approximation. You know, 1 plus x to the n, if x is small in magnitude, it's approximately 1 plus nx, just retaining the first term in the series expansion and neglecting all others. This is a good approximation. In the same spirit, this is a good approximation for cosine of theta. And a very useful thing when you're this kind of thing, we'll see it in the exercises coming out. This kind of stuff is very, very useful in physics in general. And in fact, this actually played a big role in the binomial theorem, and these sorts of considerations played a big role in Newton and calculus and all that other stuff. It's kind of like a precursor to calculus. Okay, similarly, let's look at sine of theta. Okay, given this expression for cosine of theta, I want you to guess what's the expression for sine of theta is. Those of you who actually know are not allowed to answer. This is supposed to be a genuine guessing. Well, thinking as opposed to remembering. Okay, so cosine of theta looks like this. Sine of theta looks like this. Okay. So what is the series expression for sine of theta? What's the first term? Zero, very good. Okay, zero, yep. So I'm not gonna write the zero, because it's always zero. Okay, what's the next term? Theta, very good. So the first term is theta. Now, it could actually be, you know, like 4.7 times theta. We don't actually know that. But what we do know is it's gotta be something that's just basically a straight line in theta. Because to a good approximation for values of theta, near theta equals zero, so like around here, this is basically just a straight line. And then the question is, what's the slope of that straight line? If it has a slope of 1, well, then it's just theta. If it has a slope of 2, well, it's 2 times theta. Turns out that the function is very simple, and it's just theta. It has a slope of 1. Okay, then what? What's next? Is there an x squared term? Why not? Right. Okay, so cosine is symmetric with respect to the origin. So if I put in, let's say, 0.5 or negative 0.5, because all of these terms are squared here, or sorry, I should say it this way, it is an even function. So if I put in 0.5 or negative 0.5, so a value of theta or the negative of it, I should get the same answer. So whatever the series expansion is for cosine of theta, it has to involve terms that don't care about the sign. Whether I put in a positive value of theta or the corresponding negative value, it should be squared or fourth or sixth. It should be even powers. And that's in fact what we see. This series doesn't care whether it's a positive or negative value of theta. It will give you the same answer. It just depends on the magnitude of theta. Whereas sine is the opposite. If I stick in 0.5 and negative 0.5, it's going to make a difference. Here I get some value. Here, because it's opposite, it reflects into the negative direction. Plus the value I get at 0.5 will be the negative of the value I get at negative 0.5. Okay, so my series has to have only odd powers of theta. We started with the first one, theta to the power of 1. That's an odd power of theta. Next, so what's the cubic term? So there must be a cubic term. What's the coefficient in front? How are you getting that? So you're looking at here. This is 1 over 1 factorial. I'm sorry, 1 over 0 factorial. 0 factorial is 1. And this is 1 over 2 factorial, 1 over 4 factorial, 1 over 6 factorial. So the sign is just the terms in between. So probably it's a 3 factorial. So 1 over 3 factorial. 3 factorial is 3 times 2, which is 6. Okay, what's the sign, plus or minus? How many say plus? How many say minus? And so it's minus because theta cubed, if we just theta cubed is a function which looks like this, and so obviously we wanna subtract, okay? Because this the first term just sine theta equals theta overshoots, goes too high. We need to correct it by subtracting something to bring it down. Okay, and so we subtract this theta cube, so it must be a theta. Okay, what's the next one? Plus or minus? Plus. Okay, so that's sine theta. Super. Now let's look at, let me just draw a box around that. And cosine of theta. So there's that. And finally, let's look at the function, probably the most important function in all of mathematics. What's that? E to the x. Okay, so e to the x. And there's lots of ways in which you can derive this. I'll just write down the answer. So e to the x. Well, is it worth putting in theta here? E is theta. Why not put just e to the x? So e to the x is 1 plus x minus, or sorry, plus 1 over 2 factorial x squared. Okay, so this one's actually very easy to remember. So e to the x, or e to the theta, whatever you want, is 1 plus x plus 1 over 2 factorial x squared plus 1 over 3 factorial x cubed plus 1 over 4 factorial x to the fourth. So very, very simple to remember. Okay, and the function itself, you can see, let's just graph this. Okay, so when we stick in x equals 0, what is that series give you? 1. Okay, so at x equals 0, it's 1. Okay, the first term here, if we ignore all these other terms, it's e to the x looks approximately like 1 plus x. Okay, so it's just basically this curve here, which is 0 at minus 1 here. Okay, but then there's a correction, an x squared correction, and an x cubed, and all that kind of stuff. So at the end of the day, e to the x looks like that. Okay. So out here, when x is positive, all of these terms are positive, and they get big really fast, right? If you stick in 100, okay, you get, you know, x to the fourth, 100 to the fourth, 100 to the fifth, and so on and so forth. It's a huge, huge. But because of this factorial here down here, the denominator, this series actually converges. Like you can actually stick in like big numbers, like 100. If you sum enough terms, you will get an excellent approximation to e to the x, but it takes a lot of terms. Look at what happens for negative values. E to the x actually goes to 0 for large negative values of x. So what's required here is quite remarkable. If you have a large negative value of x, like negative 100, this is negative 100. X squared is positive 10,000 with that factor of that. X cubed is negative, 6 zeros, positive 8 zeros. Okay, so you're taking a negative number, adding a really big positive number, a really big negative number, and you're alternating back and forth. And there's cancellation between those terms to such precision that you can, for large negative values of x, it basically all sums to zero. It's just a remarkable series. Okay, anyways, that's the series, and it's a very, very important series. And why it's so important, you can see why it's so important when we start looking at complex numbers. So how many of you are familiar with complex numbers? Okay, so all of you, almost all of you, how many of you have never seen a complex number? Okay, excellent. Okay, so we'll talk a little bit about complex numbers. Let's start over here. Okay. All right, so basically a complex number is a pair of real numbers. It's a point in a two-dimensional plane. So for example, if we go out some distance A along this axis and some distance B along that axis, that will define a point in this plane, which we could label just by a pair of numbers A and B. Okay, so for example, if we go out 2 along the horizontal axis and 3 along the vertical axis, we'll have a pair of numbers. The pair of numbers 2, 3 would identify that point. Or if we go, say, like negative 3 over here and say -4 over here, then the pair of real numbers -3 and -4 would identify that point. So a complex number is basically a pair of real points. It's basically a point in a plane like that. Okay, with some special properties. Okay, so first off, let me just introduce some notation. Instead of this kind of awkward notation, what we would do is we would just call. Look, this is fantastic. Okay, there's only one piece of colored chalk in the entire room, green. That's what we got. We're stuck with green. So we would call that number A plus I B. Okay, where I is just some symbol that we're using right now to separate these, to identify which real number corresponds to the horizontal axis and which real number that corresponds to the vertical axis. Okay, and this point here would be written as 2 plus I, 3. This point here would be written as -3 minus I, 4. So you get the idea. So the I is just a way of keeping track of which number corresponds to a vertical direction versus a horizontal direction. Okay, so it's just notation so far. Okay, so adding complex numbers is then very easy. So how do we do that? I guess I maybe should introduce also terminology. So this axis is called the real axis, and this axis is called the imaginary axis, for reasons that will become apparent shortly. Okay, so real and imaginary here. And so suppose we have two of these numbers. So one of them here, which is A plus I, B, and some other number, which is, say, down here, say, C plus I, D. So for this complex number, A and B are both positive. For this complex number, C and D happen to both be negative. And if we were to add these guys up, that number plus that number, what is that? Yeah. Okay, so you add these parts, A plus C, and the I in front of the B plus the I in front of the D, you can factor out the I and say that that's I and B plus D. Okay, so I is just sort of carried along as just sort of in terms of just like ordinary algebra. Okay, we'll see more properties about I for sure. Okay, so graphically, this is very simple to see. It's just like adding vectors. So if I take this vector and add that vector, if I add the A and the C give me the net real value, and the B and the D to give me the net imaginary value, it'll be, you can see quite easily that this is exactly the same as just adding vectors like parallelogram. This is a little bit Is that all clear? All right, does anyone have any questions? Because my sense is that most of you are familiar with this, so I don't want to spend a huge amount of time on it. But I want to make sure that everyone understands. Okay, so we got that. So now the interesting thing happens when we multiply complex numbers. Okay, so what we're going to do here is we're just going to follow our nose. We're just going to do what we would just what this thing says to do. So just A times C plus I times AB plus IBC plus I squared BD. Okay. So what we can do is this kind of term we're familiar with. A and C are just two real numbers, like 5 and 7. 5 times 7 is 35. A times B is just some real number. That's a real number. And we just multiplied by this algebraic symbol, I. So we can collect those two together. And so it'll be this number plus I times that number. Okay, but what about this thing? This thing is something outside of what we've really been talking about so far. Okay, so I squared is not the same as I. So, and it's not the same as necessarily just one. So what we do is we define what I squared is. And we make a definition that turns out to be hugely useful. Okay, so this is just the definition. So we define, so far I has just been used as sort of an algebraic thing to help us keep track of whether we're talking about a vertical coordinate or a horizontal coordinate. But now when we try to multiply these numbers, we're actually led to define what I squared is, and we're just going to define it to be minus 1. You know, clearly I is not an ordinary number, because any number squared is going to be positive. It's not going to be negative. Okay, so I is not a real number, and hence it's called imaginary. So the imaginary unit, or a unit, unit imaginary number. Okay, so with this definition of I, this expression here is equal to, just collect the real parts, this becomes AC, I squared is negative 1, so now that's just a real number, so it's just AC minus BD. And then we can factor out the I, and collect these two remaining terms as just AB plus BC. Okay, so now we know how to multiply. So adding was easy. To multiply, we had to define what I squared was. And we define it to be this. Okay? Why? So what? Okay, well, it turns out to be hugely useful. So let's see how that is. It looks like I'm going to erase that board. Stop me. I'm going to keep going up. Okay. So why is it so useful? Well, there's our expression for e to the x. What if we try substituting x equal to I theta? So replacing that expression for e to the x there, replace x with I theta. And we'll just see what happens. Okay, so that's 1 plus x, well, x is just I theta, plus 1 over 2 factorial x squared. X squared is now I squared theta squared. It's 1 over 3 factorial x cubed. X is I theta, so that's I cubed theta cubed. Plus 1 over 4 factorial x to the 4th. That's I to the 4, theta to the 4, plus an infinite number of terms like that. Okay, so first off, what is I squared? Minus 1. What is I cubed? If I squared is minus 1, then I cubed is I times that. So it's minus I. I to the 4 is I squared times I squared. It's negative 1 times negative 1 is plus. Plus 1. And so on. Okay? So the coefficient here is I. Coefficient here is 1. So you see a pattern here. It's 1, I, minus 1, minus I, 1. You started at 1 again, and now it's going to repeat the same pattern. And next will be I, then minus 1, then minus I, and so on. So let's collect all the real terms together. So the real terms, the terms that don't involve a factor of I, that's 1. The next one is a negative 1 times the 1 over 2 factorial. So it's negative 1 over 2 factorial theta squared. And then this is a positive 1 over 4 factorial theta to the 4th, and so on. Plus I times, now we just pull out the factor of I common to all the remaining terms, so that's a theta. And then there's a minus I comes to 1 over 3 factorial, minus 1 over 3 factorial theta cubed. And the next one, although I didn't write it down here, is a 1 over 5 factorial theta fifth. Okay, so what do we recognize the sum of these two to be? What is? So, right, so if you compare with quotient sine there, this first one is cos theta. Plus I times sine theta. Okay, so this is a hugely important relationship. Okay, so by introducing an imaginary unit, a number whose value squared is minus 1, and just treating it sort of algebraically and just sticking it into these series and so on, we find that there's a very deep relationship between the exponential function and cosine and sine, which is really remarkable because the exponential function is not periodic. The exponential function, as we just sketched, looks like this. It's not periodic. It just goes to 0 over here and goes to plus infinity over there, whereas cosine and sine are periodic functions like this. So for there to be any relationship between this function and these functions is kind of interesting. And that relationship comes out when you introduce these complex numbers. So the exponential of a pure imaginary number is some complex number whose real part is cosine of theta, whose imaginary part is sine of theta. This is a remarkable expression, extremely important. Okay, so in terms of a picture, what is that thing? In terms of the picture, it looks like this. So e to the I theta is an imaginary number, and so we should be able to put it somewhere on this imaginary, this complex plane, which has a real direction and an imaginary direction. Okay, so first of all, the real part of it is just cosine of theta, and the imaginary part is sine theta. So it's not hard to convince yourself that in fact e to the I theta is a complex number. So it's a point somewhere in this complex plane, which happens to actually lie on a unit circle. The complex number of length 1, and the angle of that complex number is theta. And you can easily see that because it's real and imaginary part. Its real part is this guy. How far do you have to go along the real axis? Well, cos theta. How far do you have to go along the imaginary axis to get to that point? Well, sine theta. Okay. And so as theta ranges, so when theta is 0, e to the I theta is this. When theta is pi by 2, you're a quarter way around the circle. E to the I pi by 2 is that. When theta is pi, e to the I pi is that. So e to the I is minus 1. Or you can write it as. That's a really cool relationship, often celebrated relationship, involving the most, basically the most important numbers in mathematics. So e and pi and I and 1 and 0. There are no other numbers, and that's it. All in one equation. Excellent. So there's that, and so basically as theta ranges between 0 and 2 pi, e to the I theta roams around the circumference of that circle. And as theta goes past 2 pi to like 4 pi, 8 pi, and so on, just keep going round and round and round. If theta is increasing, in the positive direction increasing, then that point is moving around like this. If theta is decreasing, the point is moving around like that. So e to the I theta is intimately connected with rotational motion. Okay, and so it's hugely important in all kinds of places in physics. Okay, right. Oh, and this also provides an important alternative way of representing complex numbers. So axis and the imaginary axis. So we can write a complex number as this complex number here as a plus I b. So a in the real direction and b in the imaginary direction, that takes us to our number here. We can also write this as just r. Can just write it as basically e to the I theta. So at some point, suppose that this circle of radius 1 here. Okay, so then if this is a circle of radius 1, then e to the I theta is that point. And then so we're here, and then we scale that up by a factor r. Maybe r is 5. We scale it up. Okay, and so we can either scale it up or scale it down. So we can get anywhere on the in the complex plane, either by giving sort of a real and an imaginary part, or giving the angle, whatever angle, say that angle, and how far out you're going to go. So there's the angle, and that's how far out you go. And you can see this just by e to the I theta is cos theta plus I sine theta. Okay, so that's the real part of this is r cos theta. Imaginary part is r sine theta. Okay, so we just identify this thing. This is A, and this is B. Okay. How do I express r in terms of A and B? Pythagoras, square root of A squared plus B squared. Okay, so is that all clear? That's all clear. Okay, so and then if you want to multiply two complex numbers, now it becomes easy. Okay, so multiplication of complex numbers this way was a little bit messy and hard to interpret graphically. Like adding complex numbers is easy to interpret graphically using the a plus I b notation. But when you're multiplying complex numbers, this r e to the I theta is much more convenient. Okay, so if we have say two complex numbers, one of them is say this number over here, which is at an angle alpha and a distance a away from the origin, So that's a e to the I alpha. And I have another complex number here, say, this guy over here, which is an angle beta and a distance b from the origin. This is b e to the I beta. When I take the product of those two complex numbers, it's just AB e to the I alpha plus beta. Is that clear, everyone? Okay. So what I'm doing here is I just multiply the magnitudes of these two. Suppose this is near for one and this is whatever. Then the total magnitude, suppose this is a little bigger than one. The total magnitude is, say, this long, but the important thing is that I add the angles. So I take this angle over here and I add it to that angle. So this is about 45 degrees, so I add about 45 degrees to this, is about that far. And then the length of that. So the angle of that complex number is just the sum of the angles. The length of it is just the product of A times B. Okay, so it's out there. Okay. So that's that. But why all of this stuff is important, I mean, it's cool in and of itself and all that, but really what we need them for is when we talk about quantum, when we get to quantum theory. We're going to have to really understand quantum mechanics, we really need to understand complex numbers. Complex numbers play a pretty fundamental role in doing quantum mechanics. And in particular, the way that we will be doing quantum mechanics is through waves. And so we need to understand waves a little bit. Remember that all of this math that we're doing is just to make sure everyone is on the same page, and it's to help us with the lectures. The quantum lectures are going to need us to understand, it's going to be very helpful for us to understand both real and complex waves. So we only have about 15 minutes left, so we'll probably be able to get through a little bit of discussion about real waves. And then during our quantum lecture, we'll introduce complex waves. Because, like for example, free particles, or just this thing, I throw this thing across the room, it's described, you can describe it in terms of waves, but not real waves. These are fundamentally complex waves. Okay, we need to understand what that is to have any understanding of what the quantum mechanics of this particle is all about. Okay, so let's see. I want to consider, first of all, a static wave. Typically, when we say waves, we mean moving waves. I'm going to consider a static wave first. So static wave is just a cosine wave. And the argument of the cosine, so what appears inside here, is just cosine of 2 pi times x over lambda. Lambda is the wavelength of the wave. Okay, so let's draw that function. Okay, our static wave here. So x is going to be like a distance along the x-axis, a distance in some direction, and this wave has a wavelength lambda. Okay, so that's 0, and out here is lambda, and we'll take points in between. That's lambda over 2. Lambda over 4, 3 lambda over 4, okay? And let's see. So the point about all of this is, the simplest way to see this is, as x ranges between 0 and lambda, what does x over lambda range between? As x goes from 0 to lambda, x over lambda goes from 0 to what? What does 2 pi times all that go to? Go between 0 and... Okay, so when x goes between 0 and lambda, the argument of the cosine goes between 0 and 2 pi. Okay, so if we look at our unit circle, this is gone now, but that's one full period of the cosine function. So cosine of 0 is 1. Okay, and then in x going from 0 to lambda, the argument goes from 0 to 2 pi, we have one full period of a cosine. which means you start at 1, go to negative 1, and go back up to 1 again. Okay, so we know these two points here. Okay, and we know that halfway in between, it drops down to reverse minus 1. So we know for these values, it's 0. Okay, at lambda over 4, lambda over 4 divided by lambda is a quarter. A quarter of 2 pi is a quarter of the way around the circle. Okay, a quarter of the way around the circle is over here. The cosine is the projection on this axis, so that's 0. And so these are just ways of thinking about this, helpful ways of thinking about cosines and sines. You should always sort of know what cosine of pi by 2 is, cosine of pi, sine of pi by 4. You should know these things sort of just immediately. Okay, so, and there are useful ways of thinking about it, sort of tricks in your mind to help that. Okay, so anyway, there's cosine. And of course, if x continues, then it just continues on in a periodic fashion like that, and in positive and negative directions. Okay, so that's that. Okay, so now what we want to do, so that's a static wave, not very interesting. Most waves in physics are traveling waves that are interesting. Well, that's actually not true. Some of the two traveling waves get interesting standing waves. We'll talk about that in quantum. Okay, so but we want to make that wave move now. How do we make it move in time? What do we do? Velocity. Yep. So we're going to have something related to velocity is going to figure into what we do. Mathematically, what am I going to do? How many of you have talked about traveling waves? Okay, so about half of you. Okay, so we'll spend a tiny bit of time on that. I think we'll spend exactly 10 minutes on that. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to take cosine of 2 pi x over lambda. That's just a static, boring, uninteresting wave pattern. And we're going to make it move by replacing the argument with, instead of that, it'll be cosine of 2 pi x over lambda minus 2 pi little t over big T. Okay, so this lambda here, this is the wavelength. This capital T here is the period. So the wavelength is, if I have a traveling wave like this, and I take a snapshot of it, I get something like that. And the wavelength is the crest-to-crest distance, or the trough-to-trough distance, whatever. The period is, if I let the wave go by, but just sort of sit at one point, the wave is going by. First, it's going to be plus maximum, and it's going to drop through zero, and then minus maximum, and drop to come through zero, plus maximum. So the time it takes to go from, say, a crest, and then through a trough, back to a crest again, that's the period. And that's capital T. So I'm introducing basically two variables here, the wavelength of the wave, lambda, and the period. And that's sufficient to characterize the wave. Well, also I can the amplitude, but I'm just making the amplitude 1. Okay, so and basically the ratio of these things is going to be important for the velocity. That's how the velocity enters into the picture. What is the velocity of the wave in terms of lambda and t? Well, I'll let you think about that. Okay. So there we go. Now let's actually see, as time goes on, let's see how adding this minus 2 pi t over t makes the wave move. It's very important to be able to reason like this with waves. It's going to help a lot when we're doing the quantum stuff. Okay, so at t equals 0, what do we have? So at t equals 0, we simply have cosine of 2 pi x over lambda, which is what we had before. Okay, so it's just this guy. Okay, let me shift that over a little bit. Okay, so just that cosine, well, we know that cosine goes over one complete period when x ranges from 0 to the wavelength lambda. And of course, it's also extends back here. And we're going to pay attention to that point, that particular crest on this wave. We'll call it the crest, for lack of a better word. Okay, so we got that. And this is half a wavelength, this is a quarter wavelength, that's 3/4. So let's put these guys in there. Okay, so that's not very interesting. We already know that. So t equals 0, a snapshot of our traveling wave is it just looks like that pattern. Okay, now we look at 1/4 of a cycle later. So when t is 1/4 of the full period. Okay, so that becomes, we have a cosine of 2 pi x over lambda. And it's supposed to be minus 2 pi little t over big T. Little t is now 1/4 of big T. So what are we subtracting there? Minus 2 pi times 1/4, which is what? So minus pi by 2. Okay? So you know that with a full circle, we've got 2 pi. Okay? So half a circle is pi, 1/4 of a circle is pi by 2. Okay? So we've gone 1/4 of the way around the circle, so to speak. So it's 1/4 of a full period. So what we're doing basically is the crest we are interested in occurs when the expression inside the brackets is equal to 0. That's where the crest occurs. Because cosine of 0 is 1. Okay? Cosine of 0 is 1, that crest. Okay? So what we're interested in, if we want to follow the progress of this crest, what we do is we look at for what value of x is this expression equal to 0. Okay? So for what value of x will this expression be 0? Can you work that out? Someone work it out quickly in your head or on paper? 1/4 lambda. Okay, so if we put x equal to 1/4 of the wavelength into here, we'll get 1/4 of 2 pi is pi by 2 minus pi by 2 is 0. So what it's telling us is that this crest is located now at when t is big T by 4, when we take a snapshot of our moving wave, the crest is located where x is equal to lambda by 4, 1/4 of the wavelength. So I'll just extend these lines down. So it's really useful for you to if you get a chance to do this on your own, just make sketches like this and draw the wave sort of at different snapshots of time and get a feeling for how the wave moves. Okay, so that crest now has moved from the 0 to lambda by 4, 1/4 of the full wavelength. So the crest now sits here. Okay, and then the rest just follows. The rest is now just cosine wave. I can't draw close. Like that. So our wave has moved 1/4 of wavelength there. Okay, and similarly, if we go to t equals half of the period, we're going to get cosine 2 pi x over lambda, the snapshot at this particular time. Putting in capital T over 2 for little t there, we get 1/2 of 2 pi is pi. Okay, so what value of lambda do I need to stick in for x here to make this equal to 0, to make the argument equal to 0? We're following the crest. Lambda over 2? Okay, so 1/2. Lambda over 2, that's right. Okay, so this is 0, that's 1/4 lambda, that's 1/2 lambda. So the crest has now moved there. So once I know the location of that crest that I'm tracking, I can just fill in the rest of the cosine. Okay, so it looks like that. So anyways, you get the picture. And then for larger and larger values of t, like eventually when t is 1 full period, what I'm going to get is I'm going to get cosine of 2 pi x over lambda minus 1 full period is just 2 pi minus 2 pi. what is cosine of theta minus 2 pi? Can I simplify that anyway? It's just cosine of theta, right? Because the function is periodic with a period of 2 pi, if you have any value of theta, if you add 2 pi to that, you're going to get the same. And so this is just the original. Okay, so we come back to the original. So the crest has moved full wavelength over. Anyway, so there you go. So that's a moving wave. So the basic point is you just start with a static wave like this. You stick in lambda there. X divided by lambda is a number that goes from 0 to 1 as x changes from 0 to a full wavelength. And you multiply by 2 pi because the function is periodic for the period of 2 pi. That gives you your basic static wave. To make it move, all you do is, to make it move to the right, you just subtract 2 pi, something that depends upon time. Okay, and it's convenient to write it this way, 2 pi little t, the time divided by the period. So that when the period goes from, when time goes from 0 to 1 full period, this goes from 0 to 2 pi, and, you know, and you get a nice wave. Okay, what if I, so that's a wave moving to the right. What if I wanted to have a wave moving to the left? What do I do? Add. Okay, so it's minus for a wave moving to the right, and it's plus for a wave moving to the left. Okay? So that's going to be important. We're going to need to know all of that. Okay, so at the end of the day, which is right now, what you get to is basically, I'll just show you just very, very quickly, and then we'll pick this up again when it's going to make more sense for you in the quantum lecture. So I'll just give you sort of a tiny preview of why all of this stuff matters and why you should be thinking about it and maybe working on these exercises tonight or tomorrow or whatever. Okay, so I'll just say just a couple of words about that. This is way cool. So basically, this is a basic traveling wave. And at the end of the day, I'll just sketch it for you. At the end of the day, I said that if I throw this particle across the room, it's like a free particle. And quantum mechanically, that's described by a wave. Well, it's not described by a cosine wave or a sine wave, any real waves like that. It's described by a complex wave. And that complex wave looks like this. So this is the x-axis here. And I'm throwing my particle along that x-axis. And then I have a real axis like this. If that particle were described by, say, a cosine wave, it would look like this. The wave along that x-axis, along the path of that particle, the particle maybe is located here, but the wave extends, well, okay. anyways, quantum mechanically, the particle is spread out, and it's described by, say, a cosine wave. Suppose you think it's described by a cosine wave. Well, then it would look something like that. And that would be it, and then this continues on this way. It's just an infinite wave train like this. So. Okay, and so if you take a snapshot of that particle, that quantum particle, it would be described by this frozen wave there. But as time goes on, that wave is in motion. It's a traveling wave, traveling to the right. What do you think the velocity of that wave is compared to the velocity of the particle? But is there a relationship between the sort of the classical velocity of the particle and the velocity of the associated quantum wave? Let me say same. Let me say different. Let's just say different. It is different, but hopefully we'll see why if we have time. Okay, so whatever. So this is actually not how a particle is described. A particle requires, the wave is actually complex. It requires both a real and an imaginary part. So instead of just a real axis like this, we draw another axis, an imaginary axis coming out of the page, and we consider a complex wave, or sorry, a pure imaginary sine wave. So this is cosine of this argument here. It's the wave traveling to the right described by this cosine. And then we add an imaginary sign. And so let's see how well I can do this. Uh, I think it's a useful exercise to try to sketch these things yourself as well. Okay, so a sine function drawn in the imaginary direction there starts at zero, and then a quarter of a period later over out here is maximum, and then half a period later it's dropped to zero. So like that. Okay. So is that a super sketch or what? All right. Okay. So the wave has both a real and an imaginary part. The real part is a cosine traveling wave. The imaginary part is this guy, is I times sine. And so in fact, at any point in time, if you were to freeze this wave, you were to freeze it right, freeze it here and look at this point on the x-axis, well, its value is just 1. If you were to, freeze it at this time but look at it further down the x-axis, well, it has no real part, but it has this imaginary part. Its value is just plus I. Okay, and so in fact, the wave is actually a spiral kind of wave, and I'll show you some animations of this. I just thought I would do it kind of. It's actually a spiral kind of a wave, and we will have some nice animations next time you see this wave. So it's like a corkscrew. So a quantum particle is described by a corkscrew kind of complex wave moving in whatever direction. It's really, really cool. And the reason for this is really cool. And we will talk all about that in your quantum stuff. So that sort of concludes our math stuff. That's basically all the math you need to know. So what I encourage you to do on your way out here, the idea is we're going to have some lunch now, fantastic food in the bistro. What I would encourage you to do is come up here. And pick up, so there's those four sets here. You've already picked up the binomial series set, so let me just leave that aside here. But there's 1, 2, 3, 4 sets of handouts with solutions. You've already picked up one of the handouts. You just need the solutions. So let me try to arrange this so it isn't a total disaster when you come through here. So just pick up one copy of everything here as you file by. And then finally, there's also a vectors and matrices. So some of you I know have more of a background in this math and would like to go further with all of it. So there's a bit of discussion about vectors and matrices, which might be helpful with your mentoring sessions or not, depending on the mentor that you choose. Okay, so I would also encourage you to pick up one of these as well. And so is that it? And so then this afternoon at 1 o'clock, we're going to start with special relativity. And then we're going to have a really cool special topic. Special guest, Sean Gribb, is going to come in. He's a great guy. And we're going to talk about the world as a hologram. This is going to blow your mind, totally blow your mind. And this afternoon is actually here in this room. Yep.